Well, welcome back after the 3 o'clock news. That's Billy Ocean with Love Train. And isn't that appropriate, because love is in the air, as they say. And I've got Helen Young sitting right next to me. Helen is a partner at Debenhams Otway, which, well, they're a large solicitors, family lawyers, I should say, just around the corner from here. Helen in particular provides legal advice on high net worth and complex financial cases and representation in divorce proceedings. Oh, my, my, my. Well, I'm going to learn something this afternoon. I'm not sure I'll make use of it, but she also represents clients in multi-million pound cases, both in contested proceedings and negotiated settlements. And she also advises on pre- and post-nuptial agreements. Post-nups, lovely word, isn't it? Put that on there. When I tweeted, I called it a pre- and a post-nup. Nup. Sounds like, what's his name, Mr. Bean? I'm a nup. Anyway, we'll give her a chance to get her breath back, because I've got a track queued. I thought this is right for we're talking about weddings and what have you. And whoa. Yes, and of course that's Roy C with his Shotgun Wedding. And well, we did debate what we should play, and I think it was Helen said she thought it might be DIV, you know, the what's it, divorce, whatever, but no. So welcome to Radio Verulam, Helen.
Thank you, Ian, thanks for inviting me along.
Oh, it's this subject for me, I mean, I know you get hitched and sometimes you get unhitched. And in between, there's obviously a lot can happen.
Well, indeed. I mean, a lot of our work that we do on a day-to-day is around people divorcing and about financial settlements and issues they might have about the children. But increasingly, we're finding that people are interested in trying to take control of their own affairs. Mm-hmm. And often what that means is either having a prenuptial agreement before they tie the knot.
Yes.
Or looking at a postnuptial agreement if perhaps maybe things aren't going so well, or if there's a little bit of uncertainty in the future for people, then they can try and take control, usually of their own financial situation, but again, we can talk about and try and discuss matters in relation to the children and any other issues they may have, you know, in their relationship.
And which one is predominant then, pre or post?
Prenup, I would say.
Prenup, yeah.
And certainly we've seen quite a large increase in inquiries. Mm-hmm. From all sorts of people.
Is this triggered by the popularity from Hollywood and, you know, that sort of thing?
Well, I suppose to some degree it's what people get to know about if the celebrities are doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, you might want to do it. But what we find, sometimes we get a lot of concerned parents. Perhaps they've given money to children. Uh-huh. The children are about to embark on their marriage. And the parents want to know that their funds will, you know, hopefully and ultimately stay with them.
Stay under their
with
control.
With their child.
Yeah. Yes, of course. Yeah. So how do people go about it then?
So basically, usually just an initial inquiry by phone. Hopefully they do it in good time before the marriage. Trying to do it in the sort of 7-day run-up isn't going to work.
How long does it take then?
It depends how complicated they want it to be. Mm-hmm. Usually we have a first meeting, ideally 3 or 4 months before the intended ceremony, so that we can get an idea of the areas that they want to cover. We have to have all of the assets disclosed. They each have to give each other information about their assets. So to gather that information in always takes a bit of time.
Right.
So as I say, usually 3 to 4 months is ideal. Sometimes it's longer, sometimes it's shorter. Mm-hmm. You know, we work with clients, you know, as quickly as we have to. But there is no set time that you have to execute it before the ceremony, but usually if it gets within a month of it, we'll say, look, it's getting too close, you're leaving yourself open for subsequent arguments about duress and pressure.
I see, yes. So what happens then? People come to you, they go through the procedure, list all their items, you know, belongings, money, etc., the kids, the lot, and then what, you make out a legal document then, do you?
Yes, so basically we draw it up as an agreement. That agreement has to be signed by both parties, but they must be independently advised. So there has to be an understanding that it's at arm's length, so there's no question that one party's being coerced by the other.
Can that be different partners in your company, or do they have to go to different?
No, they would go to a different practice. Uh-huh. Because although in theory you can build Chinese walls, in practice, it's far better to have them separately.
You don't want to end up in the bar later that day saying, "Hey, you know what he said," and all that. No.
Well, of course, we wouldn't be that unprofessional.
No.
No, but you know, it has to be that it's seen to be something that's absolutely independent and something that they're entering into without coercion.
Okay, who normally gets the process rolling? Is it?
Well, it's funny. As I say, sometimes it'll be concerned parents who'll come to us. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll have somebody say, "Well, we've both decided that we want to have that. Can we both come to see you?"
Yes.
And of course, we have to explain about the independent nature of the advice. And of course, it's not the most romantic thing
that somebody's
going to do. But I mean, you know, we see people in all different circumstances. We have people who maybe at second marriage, third marriage, they've got children or grown-up children that they want to provide for. So, you know, there's all sorts of people who'll come to us. Some decide to go ahead with it, and some decide it's not for them.
Now, that's sort of more pre-nup, but what about the post-nuptial? How does that come about?
Well, as I say, again, it really depends on individual circumstances. Probably the most common scenario is where you've got a couple who perhaps aren't getting on so well. Maybe they've had some difficulties. Maybe one person's done something that has led to there being trust issues within the relationship. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things they might address is, well, you know, how can we rebuild that trust? And what can we do to put something in place that gives us control of things if things do go wrong and if we decide to separate?
Yes indeed. Okay, well, that's quite a bit to take in. Should we have a 2-minute break or however, well, it's actually 3 minutes 15 seconds. And it's a rather appropriate track as well. It's Barry White and You're the First, My Last, My Everything. That's Barry White, the large Barry White. You're my first, my last, my everything. And quite appropriate. I'm back with Helen Young, who's a partner from Debenham Otway. We were going to summarise, Helen. We went through quite a few things there. So you quickly give us a quick summary of what we went through.
Yeah, well, we were talking about pre- and post-nuptial agreements and just the type of things that people might want to try and safeguard if they enter into this sort of agreement. I think it's worth saying, because I didn't say it previously, that post- and prenuptial agreements are not legally binding in this country if you come to divorce. But there's a big but to that. If you've entered into an agreement with certain safeguards in place, then the courts have said that they will uphold the agreement if they are fair and if they meet all of the needs of the parties and the parties' children, if there are children involved. So part of what we have to do is evaluate what they have and what they would need if they came to separate. Because if you've got one person who's got a lot more assets than the other, then of course if you don't make adequate provision for the other person, then the other person can still apply to the divorce judge for a settlement that will meet their needs.
Yes. Isn't that how laws are made in the first place, though? By, you know, something is put into place, worked upon, a judge accepts it, and then don't you then go to your vast array of books and say, but in 1976 the judge said, and it becomes almost like law, isn't it?
Indeed. So what we have is we have legislation, so we have primary legislation, and then we have cases that are decided by the courts, obviously depending on the individual circumstances of that particular case. But we then take precedents from the cases that are decided. And back in 2010, there was a case that went all of the way to the Supreme Court, precisely around the validity of a prenuptial agreement. So, of course, that's the highest court yes. In England and Wales for us. So that's very persuasive. And in fact, a year ago, the Law Commission recommended to the government that we have legislation to make nuptial agreements legally binding. Oh, okay. But of course, those recommendations haven't yet been put in place. Mm-hmm. But we certainly look at the matters that were set out in that report, and we follow the guidance that's been given.
Right.
Because of course, if legislation does come in, we want our nuptial agreements that we're dealing with now mm-hmm. to stand the test of that.
Yeah, so you think it's probably just a matter of time then before that gets on the statute book?
I think it's difficult to say. We've just had a change in government.
Of course.
I'm sure there's going to be lots of other things on the table for them to deal with.
Yes.
So I think it's a watch this space sort of situation.
We'll watch the space. Now, more importantly, what happens if we don't make agreements of this nature and we just blunder on in, you know?
Well, of course, if you don't have an agreement, then when you come to separate, you've got no certainty as to what's going to happen with your assets. Mm-hmm. People argue about all sorts of things. You know, was it my asset to start with? Has it become a marital asset?
Right.
And over the years, I've had arguments about, you know, lots of money down to, you know, pets and fish tanks.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, people will argue about a myriad of things.
Yes, yes.
And the court process is very slow. If you start an application for your finances to be dealt with by the court, you could find yourself in a year's time still not having any resolution.
Oh, wow.
And of course, you put the decision in the hands of somebody who's outside of your control.
Yes, yes.
So if you think about it, would you rather at least have something in place that you can hopefully rely upon?
Yes.
Or would you rather be, subject to the court process, which is extremely stressful and expensive, I would say.
Hmm. But one thing strikes me, of course, is that maybe I think, well, you know, I'm getting a bit, I should force the issue. And what about if her back home, you know, indoors, as they say, and she says, no way. Well, how do you resolve that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, it's a voluntary process. Mm. So, you know, you both have to agree to it.
Yes.
You can't force the other person into it. But lots of people want to be able to say, right, if this happens, then I want to have control of it. I don't want to have to go through that expensive process. I don't want to argue with you. Mm-hmm. And we're always trying to find ways of negotiating agreements outside of the court process.
Yes.
But having this sort of agreement in place hopefully means that you avoid any disputes when it comes to the point of separation.
Okay. Now, there's pre and there's post-nuptials. Is there something equivalent for non-nuptial, if you know what I mean?
Non-nuptials.
Partnerships, effectively.
Yes, well, you can certainly have this sort of an agreement in relation to a civil partnership.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, we're also seeing people who are coming to us to say, look, we're living together. Often they'll have bought a house together, but often they'll want to cover wider issues mm-hmm. about, you know, what happens if we don't continue. So, yes, we can also deal with what we call living together
yes.
agreements. Some people who live together just will have a sort of straightforward declaration of trust in mm-hmm. relation to the property that they own. It really depends on what they want to do. But just one important thing is that an agreement needs to be reviewed, because people's circumstances change.
Of course, yes, yes.
And if you don't review it, it may not be fit for purpose.
Right.
So
then
things
the courts
like,
might throw it out then. Or?
Well, exactly. So, I mean, if you enter into an agreement as two 20-somethings with no children,
mm-hmm.
And then you try and rely on that agreement in 15 years' time when you've got three children.
And two dogs.
Two dogs, a cat, and whatever else you might have, you know, it's not going to be fit for purpose.
Yes, I can see the point of that. Yes, yeah. Excellent. Okay, well, I've learned quite a bit. So I'm not sure how it affects me in real life, but I have
hopefully
to think about that.
At all. one, Ian.
Well, I have to think about that one, you know, as you get older, and we all do, of course. Well, that was fantastic. Any final point you want to make then?
No, just, you know, it's about taking control of your own affairs, thinking about it, just thinking about all the options, even if you decide not to go down that particular route.
Okay, that's wonderful. Well, thank you, Helen. That's now, what can I find to play you to move on with? Well, the Christians with an ideal world, maybe.